welcome to Aerian Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 9th of March 2020, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at RadioAlbion.com. Once again, we are starting another week of glorious programming here at Radio Albion, and I'm very pleased to say that I have my co-host with me today, Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good afternoon to you, sir. How are you doing? How's your weekend been?
I'm very well indeed. The weekend's been a very good weekend, actually. I think we've got the beginnings of spring weather here, and all of the good things that comes with sunshine to look forward to as the year progresses.
All of the good things to look forward to, like the Hope Not Hate State of Hate report, which actually came out last week, which of course we don't really look forward to. It's basically a rag that's not even fit for wiping your backside on, I would suggest, but people do look to it and they get upset if they don't get featured in it. And there was a mention of Radio Albion in it. I think there was a mention of Western Spring in it, but basically the angle that they are trying to push this year is that nationalists are all Satanists, which I think is probably why they don't really want to draw attention to Radio Albion, because it's quite obvious from anybody that takes a cursory glance at our website that we are pro-Christian. We're certainly not Satanists. The other thing they're trying to push in this report is the idea that nationalists are terrorists. They call the Telegram app Terrorgram, and they talk about Terror Wave, which is apparently the new form of Fashwave. I haven't actually heard of Terror Wave myself, and I do think it's disingenuous of them to try and promote this idea that nationalists are devil worshippers looking to carry out violent acts, because that's the complete opposite of what we are about. But one other thing they did in this report is to attack the Conservative Party and claim that they were Islamophobic and they have a problem with Islamophobia. And you would think that with the Conservative Party that are supposed to be a centre-right party, they would have ridiculed this. They would not want anything to do with Hope Not Hate. They would not want to be seen to be carrying out their instructions, or, you know, you would expect them to denounce them and say, look, this is a left, extreme left-wing activist organisation. We don't want to pay any attention to them. But instead of that, apparently they have actually done exactly what Hope Not Hate demanded of them. A Conservative councillor from Bolton has been suspended as the party looks into allegations of Islamophobia. Councillor Derek Bullock, who was elected in Halton last year, has been suspended from the Tories pending further investigation. The suspension is a neutral act for an investigation to take place and does not imply any wrongdoing. It comes after anti-fascism advocacy group Hope Not Hate called on the Conservative Party to take decisive steps to deal with its Islamophobia crisis. Councillor Bullock was named on a list of councillors, activists and members accused of sharing anti-Muslim content online. He allegedly posted an article on social media from Jihadi Watch about former party chairman Saeed Avazi commenting, "She's been a cuckoo in the nest." Councillor Bullock also shared a Daily Mail article about the number of Muslim children in England and Wales doubling over a decade, adding, "The clock is ticking." Both of those things are just facts, I would suggest. I wouldn't say that they were Islamophobic or born out of discrimination against Muslims. They're just facts. Council leader David Greenhalgh said, "All those found to be party members have been suspended immediately, pending investigation. The swift action we take on not just anti-Muslim discrimination, but discrimination of any kind is testament to the seriousness with which we take these issues." You would think that they would be more concerned about this left-wing parallel intelligence agency that seems to have carte blanche to basically spy on people on the right wing and harass them and hassle them. You would think they would be concerned about that, not concerned about bending to their will and doing what they want them to do. I mean, you would think that they would be more concerned about all these white girls that have been groomed and raped and want to get that report out into the public rather than start getting rid of their councillors and accusing them of being Islamophobic. I mean, what do you make of the Hope Not Hate report and this instance of them basically giving in to them?
Well, I think it's very sad, really, that establishment political parties are just crumbling and falling on their knees whenever Hope Not Hate attack them. It seems that Hope Not Hate have got a kind of a card that they can play, whether it's the fact that they've got very influential people at the top of the organization or who favor the organization, who are able to exercise undue influence in, first of all, enabling them to survive and do the hateful work that they do. The thing that strikes me most is the fact that they're able to do all the things that they do without any kind of questioning, without any due diligence on the part of establishment organizations to establish whether what they're actually printing is true or not. And there are lots of things that have been written by Hope Not Hate and the individuals associated with it, which are questionable and which would tend to suggest that they have, at the very least, massively gilded the lily in lots of the things that they print. And I think this sort of Satanist aspect as well that's being promoted at the moment by Hope Not Hate is just, you know, completely patent nonsense, really. When you what's going to happen next? We're going to have Hope Not Hate claiming that nationalists are cannibals or something like this. You know, is there some other more weird, wacky, evil sounding thing that we can be accused of doing, when in reality, the vast majority of people, in fact, I've never met anybody who claims to be a Satanist within nationalism, and I've been an active nationalist for something like 40 years or more. You know, whatever degree of Satanism there is within the ranks of nationalism, it's no more than the levels of Satanism that exist in society in general, in my view. It may well be that there may be the individual, you know, one wacky individual that can be pointed to as an example, but that person is very much the exception rather than the rule. And it is just peddling hate. You know, Hope Not Hate are peddling hate with this attempt to link nationalism with Satanism, and also with the general attempt to link in the minds of the public nationalism with terrorism. You know, there have been a number of organizations that have been proscribed by the various Home Secretaries of the time, but these organizations have been proscribed because they committed offences or are believed to have committed offences which are in breach of the Terrorism Act, although I don't think any of them have actually committed any acts that the general public would tend to associate with terrorism, i.e. I don't think any of them have actually killed anybody. So very much a matter of trumping up evidence that is virtually, which is in fact non-existent, and trying to make, try just generally trying to smear nationalism rather than fulfill any useful function.
Yeah, you bring up the people that have actually been charged with terrorism. That's fairly small, but there was also a report that came out last week. I think it was in the Independent, where they were saying that there have actually been more far right people arrested for terrorism last year than there were Asians arrested for terrorism last year. And of course, you've got to look at the word there, arrested, not actually charged and found guilty, but arrested. And, you know, a lot of people may get arrested and accused of terrorism, but they may not actually have carried anything out. I mean, you can just think of Paul Golding. Right now, he's being charged under the Terrorist Act, but that was because he refused to hand over his password at the airport. But the really concerning thing about Hope Not Hate is that they are looked to as experts, and yet they are completely discredited. I mean, from the Tommy Robinson video that he did on Panorama, that totally discredited Hope Not Hate, and yet they are still turned to by the journalists in the media to talk about nationalists, basically. They will just turn to them and they will repeat everything that they tell them. And I have experience of this, journalists just repeating what Hope Not Hate have told them. And, you know, it's a pack of lies. And if that wasn't concerning enough, you've then got the courts that seem to pay attention to them as well. And they just get away with it. Nobody seems to challenge them and point out that actually what they're saying is not true. And it's very dangerous for them to be saying these sort of things about people. I mean, they caused violence at the Generation Identity Conference a couple of years back, and they were very proud of that. They encouraged violence or threats of violence at a hotel where revisionists were meeting a couple of years back. And all of it is by, as you say, gilding the lily, by making up these exaggerations, these ludicrous ideas, accusing people of things, just hoping that if they throw enough mud at them in the hopes that some of it may stick. And if this was going on with any other community in society that was being targeted in this way, that organization would be doing prison time. I mean, they literally stalk nationalists. They stalk nationalists. They follow them around. They try to get pictures of them. And these are people that, you know, try to keep their identities secret out of a desire for security and to protect their families. And they try to stalk them. You know, they send spies into private events and conferences, like they did to the London Forum. If that had been anybody else that was having private conferences and a private meeting of friends, and there was somebody that had snuck in there and was secretly filming people and stalking them, you know, I think they would be breaking stalking law, and you know, they would be the ones that go to prison. But it just seems that the nationalist community is just seen as fair game. And this organization can just do whatever they want. I mean, they did have an MP, Ruth Smeeth, and she was voted out in the last election. And one of their head honchos has recently stepped down, and we don't know the reason for that. But quite clearly, they have an influence over the Conservative Party, who was supposed to be a right-wing party. And this is an extreme left organization. It's very sinister, I think.
And in the latest book that Matthew Collins wrote about the about national action, he actually admits in the book that Hope Not Hate committed an offence under the Terrorism Act by maintaining a mole within an organisation that had been prescribed as a terrorist organisation. And so with an admission like that in that book, one would have thought that the police would have investigated this and some action would have been taken, because it may have been somebody may say, well, you know, they were trying to do good. Well, the law is as it is in order to prevent miscarriages of justice. And so I would say that it is the duty of the police to look into this issue, because a number of the people who've been convicted as a result of the evidence which it would appear to have evidence which would have appeared to have been illegally obtained as a result of the illegal maintenance of a mole within a suspected terrorist organisation. Some of those people, it may well be that they've been unfairly convicted and that their convictions would be thrown out if they were reconsidered by the courts.
Well, apparently, from people that have actually read that book — I haven't read the book, but it's full of falsehoods. And, you know, that trial, they ended up having to have, I think, three attempts, and half the people were found innocent after having been jailed for over a year and smeared as being terrorists. And when it actually came down to the court trial, half of them were found to not have been members of National Action, and they were unjustly jailed. And yet you've got this book that makes Hope Not Hate out, their mole, out to be this great, wonderful hero who saved Britain from acts of terrorism. And his evidence wasn't taken in the court. His evidence was seen as too shaky. And yet they've made this book out that, which is apparently, as I say, it smears a lot of people, and nothing's been done about it. There's evidence that's been put on Twitter. I can't recall the name of the account right now. I think he called himself Nick Bowles, like a sort of pun on Nick Lowles. And he was putting up evidence to show that when they had this mole within the prescribed organization, they were encouraging the prescribed organization to think that the mole was somebody else. And there was a plot to murder this person that they thought was the mole, and Hope Not Hate were encouraging them to think that this other person was the mole. So they were literally encouraging murder themselves. And that there's evidence to show that. The evidence has been put on Twitter, and we can only hope that that evidence finds its way to some lawyer somewhere that then tries to take them to court over this, because they are a law unto themselves. They do act like a parallel spy organization, which, as far as I'm aware, you can't have parallel intelligence operations working in the country, but they seem to get away with it. They call themselves a charity, yet all they do is target members of the nationalist community. You imagine if we had a charity and we just targeted the gay community, or we just targeted the black community, we would be accused of profiling and race hate and religious hate, and yet they are allowed to do that because we're nationalists and we don't have civil rights.
The Charities Commission's rules as well.
Yeah, well, do you want to elaborate on that a bit, Max, about the Charities Commission?
Well, as far as the Charity Commission is concerned, their rules are that charities cannot have primarily political objectives. And I think it's fairly clear with Hope Not Hate that they're, although they try to dress up the fact that they're trying to alleviate the effects of discrimination, things of that sort, I think it's fairly clear that 90% of their activity is devoted to, as you say, harassing and carrying out spying operations and black propaganda operations on the nationalist community, and these are all things that are political in their nature, rather than them being benevolent or charitable. And so, therefore, it would appear to me that Hope Not Hate have got an overwhelmingly political objective, and that they only use charitable words in order to pay lip service so that they can, so they've got a some kind of credence in terms of claiming to be a charity, which I don't think that they should qualify. I mean, one of the things is that I would invite anybody to do is if you read I wouldn't advise you to read Matthew Collins' book, the first book that he wrote. I can't think what the full title of it is now off the top of my head, but it was called Hate, Life Inside the Far Right, or something like that. But he writes in here that the turning point for him, because he was originally a member of the British National Party, and he claims that whilst he was in the British National Party, that he engaged in lots of violent acts. So he's somebody who is admitting to having been the worst kind of person that that might have been thought to be amongst the ranks of the of nationalist organizations, but he says that the turning point for him, his road to Damascus conversion, took place during an attack on a meeting that took place in a meeting room in Welling Library. And in the description of this, I'm not quoting the actual words, but he basically says that members of the British National Party all assembled in the Welling bookshop that existed at the time, and that there were around about 40 nationalists that were all there, all very grim-faced, hard-nosed men, etc., who then all loaded themselves up into a furniture van of some sort and were then transported down to Welling Library, where there was a meeting room. And he then describes a scenario where these nationalists all charge into this meeting room and then beat up the people they find inside. And Matthew Collins portrays the majority of the people inside as being Pakistani women and children, tries to pretend or tries to give the impression that this was a very grotesque attack, etc. But the one thing that people haven't tended to do when they've been analysing the truth or not of this of these claims is the fact that if you go to the Welling bookshop, the Welling Library website, which is on the internet, then you can see there the meeting room being advertised, and you can see that it actually quotes the size of the meeting room. And this meeting room was supposed to have had something like 20 left-wing and anti-racist activists meeting in that room. And the room is really just about big enough to get 20 people seated in that room. But then we're then led to believe that another 40 nationalists all piled into this same room. And so that we then had 60 people in a room, which is only big enough to actually accommodate 20 people. And that there is supposed to then be enough room for people to actually fight. When in reality, if you actually sit and draw a scale diagram of the room and draw scale diagrams of people from above, and you try and squeeze them all into the room, they would be squeezed in like sardines. They would all be pressed chest to chest, chest to back, shoulder to shoulder, to get all those people in that room. And so it just makes a nonsense of the fact that 40 people were supposed to have invaded this room and beaten up the 20 people who were in there, because you just couldn't have got that many people in the room.
So that's just a sort of fantasy that you're going to see. I mean, I'll just interject there, Max, and say, you know, I've been involved in nationalism now, I don't know, maybe 10 years, and I've been to lots of meetings and I've met lots of people. And in all that time, I have never once heard of anybody engaging in any acts of violence against an ethnic minority or a religious minority, or making plans to get involved in anything like that. And if anybody had, that would have been the last I ever had to do with them. You know, this is a falsehood that gets portrayed about how nationalists are. Now, I wasn't involved in nationalism in the 70s, the 80s, not in the 90s. So I can't say what went on in those decades. But in the 10 years that I've been involved in it, I've never known any violence to occur from our side. I have seen violence occur from the left. I've been at a meeting where rocks were thrown through the windows, where I had about 10 people turned up hooded and masked with motorcycle chains, and there was a big fight outside. And the guy that was security said they had murder in mind. These people had murder in mind. They were brutal. They attacked the elderly men that were outside. They punched a woman in the face. As I say, they smashed the windows. The police were called. They never managed to find them. There was boasting about this online as well, that this meeting had been attacked. And as I say, this was the left that did this. And all the time that I've been involved, I've never once heard of nationalists planning on violence, ever, at all. Have you, Max? I mean, this story that is written in that book, has it ever been like a glint of that ever happening in your decades involved in nationalism?
No. In fact, I can tell the story of a meeting that took place when I was in the BNP myself. In the town that I was living in at the time, there was an advertisement went out in the local newspaper that a new anti-nationalist organization was going to be created, and it invited people that wanted to attend to assemble in these council chambers at a certain time on a certain date. And I was active, as I say, in the BNP at that particular point, and we arranged for something like 20 to 25 BNP members to go along and attend this meeting. Now, we didn't go along there with the intention of fighting anybody or doing anything of that sort. We just went along there because we wanted to take part in the meeting to make sure that the meeting was that falsehoods weren't put about in the meeting, and just to see the size of the people that were going to be carrying out a campaign against us at some point in the future. We got to the meeting room and we all sat round, and it turned out that there were only about 10 people who were left-wing activists that had turned up in order to organise this meeting. And they were very surprised and really, really chuffed that so many people had turned up to their meeting. And they got us all in and we all sat round this big table in this room. And the person who had organised the meeting then gave his introductory speech, and we sat and listened to him, what he had to say. And then he said that there are lots of new people in the meeting here today. I wonder if we could go around the table and ask everybody to introduce themselves. And so he started with the person immediately to his left, who was some sort of a trade union activist. Next person was somebody who'd been a member of the Communist Party or something of that sort. And we started going around the table until we got to the very first nationalist, who then said, "My name is whatever his name was, and I'm a member of the British National Party." And you could then see these 10 people, their chins just hit their chest with with shock at the fact that a British National Party member had attended their meeting. And then as they went around the room, as there were more and more people identified themselves as members of the British National Party, these people were absolutely went white with fear. And then they all went and huddled together in a corner. And then turned around and said, right, we're going to, we want to ask all of you members of the British National Party to leave. We then pointed out to them that it was a public meeting, that they called a public meeting. So therefore, the public were invited, were entitled to attend the meeting. And we hadn't it come to cause any trouble. We'd come to participate in the meeting. One of their members then ran off and came back with a police officer. And this police officer asked what we were doing there. And we just explained that we'd attended to participate in the meeting. We weren't planning to do anything illegal or whatsoever. And we pointed out to the police officer that it was a public meeting. And so therefore we had every right to attend the public meeting, which he agreed was the case. And so the organizers were then faced with a situation where they where they either had to continue the meeting, knowing that two thirds of the people sitting there listening to them were nationalists, the very people that they had called the meeting in order to organize opposition to. And in the end, they decided to just abandon the meeting and go away, and which they did. They wandered off, and we then went our way as well. And that was that. And so this was an example of activism on the part of nationalists, where we frustrated the efforts of the far left to organize against us, because our experience has been that the these far left groups organize in a way where they actually do plan violence. And that's probably why they didn't want to discuss their aims and intentions, because they probably were going to plan violence against our people, where they do plan to spy on nationalists, where they when nationalists stand in elections, they go to the notice boards outside of the of county halls and town halls, where they can then find the names and addresses of the various people who are standing as candidates for nationalist organizations. And then very often those nationalists then find that there are attacks or there's vandalism directed at them at their homes. And so, you know, we felt that it was necessary that we we frustrated the attempts of these people to form an active group in our town. And that's exactly what happened. But it was all done peacefully. It was all done in a very civilized way. And it was done without any violence on our part. Yeah, and that's the way that nationalists tend to operate.
Yeah, if you look at the left wing sort of propaganda, that, you know, a very common thing that you'll see is smash the fash or kill Nazis. I mean, the very language that they use is evocative of extreme violence. And you'll never see that from the nationalist side. You won't see calls for beating people up or calls for violence. You might see that on the extreme nationalist side, the sort of groups that recently have been banned. I forget the names of them, to do with like the Atomwaffen. That's that sort of thing. And that's underground. That's just a small group. And that's not representative of nationalism in general. That's the sort of group that Hope Not Hate are trying to blow out of all proportions and claim that all nationalists are like that. But when you look at it round the other way, you will see that this smash the fash and all these images of Nazis with boots going down on them or being beaten up, you will see that is mainstream. That is the sort of thing that you would see on a website like Hope Not Hate, cheering when violence has been directed against nationalists. And thinking of meetings there, I mean, the sort of thing that used to go on, people like Colin Jordan, he would hide himself at these left-wing meetings and then pop out in the middle of the meeting, and that would be his demonstration. And you know, I mean, that's a pretty courageous thing to do, but you know, maybe that wasn't so clever, because that sort of got this idea in that it was an idea to surprise people within their meetings. And you know, you did hear of occasionally there being violence at meetings, especially of the British Union of Fascists. And I think after the war there were these these Jewish anti-fascist organizations that prided themselves on the violence that they carried out against nationalists. There was a book written recently by one of the members of these Jewish anti-fascist organizations, and the press was praising it. What a wonderful book. And it's just full of stories of violence that these guys carried out on nationalists. It's completely the opposite way around to the way that it's portrayed in the press. And as I say, I've never heard of anybody preparing violence against anybody on the left. I've only heard of people preparing of ways to avoid any encounters with the left and trying to avoid violence. I added something to the website the other day, which I thought was very, very profound. Actually, a quote from Jared Taylor. And he said, if we don't have a peaceful solution, then we have no solution. And that's the truth of it. You know, we're a very small community, and you know, we can't take the state on. We have to achieve our aims through peaceful means. Otherwise, we will fail. And you know, I truly believe that. And I do think nationalists are mischaracterized as being violent. And you could see that there in that meeting, Max, as you say, you know, their faces went white and, you know, they would all have been terrified. But all you were there to do is, you know, have a dialogue with them and see what they were planning. And, you know, a lot of the people on the left will say, well, you know, the nationalist ideas need to be exposed and they need to be challenged, and then we can show the world, you know, how ridiculous their ideas are. But that never happens. That never happens. You just get groups like Hope Not Hate that also have a page in this State of Hate report talking about how great deplatforming is, which is basically just removing people's freedom of speech, freedom of speech, removing people's freedom of association. And they brag about this. They're very proud of the fact that they deny people the ability to speak. And that's because they know that they can't defeat our ideas. But so much of the left think that they can because they've never heard our ideas, because they just go along with this deplatforming thing that they do. But yeah, it's just a shame to see that the Conservative Party have just buckled under the weight of Hope Not Hate, because it's basically saying, you know, well, who's in charge? Is it you, Boris, or is it Nick Lowles and Hope Not Hate? Shameful behavior by them. Anyway, I don't know if you want to add anything more to that, Max, or shall we get on with continuing with Cecil Rhodes, our greatest Briton for the week?
No, I think we've pretty much exhausted that story.
Okay, well, last week we sort of set the scene, didn't we? You were talking about South Africa and the different tribes that we had there, and the San, who were these Bushmen, and then the Congolese came down after the San, and once the civilization was built there, it sort of became a magnet for these blacks to come there and work, and they had their own towns, they had their own shanty towns. Apparently today they talk about it being so horrific, apartheid, but what it basically was, they lived amongst their own people, and the white people lived amongst their own people, and the blacks were able to make use of the fact that there was all this employment that had been created there, and all this food and wealth that was there. I mean, South Africa became a huge magnet for all the black people on the continent, and it also became a huge magnet for white people and white settlers and trackers and gold miners and people looking for diamonds. And Cecil Rhodes was one of these. But before he actually went out there to South Africa, while attending Oriel College, Rhodes became a Freemason. And although initially he did not approve of the organization, he continued to be a South African Freemason until his death in 1902. The shortcomings of the Freemasons, in his opinion, later caused him to envisage his own secret society with the goal of bringing the entire world under British rule. According to Carol Quigley, he set up the Round Table movement to this end. And of course, we know a lot of the nefarious activities that Freemasons have been involved in over the years, but that doesn't mean that everybody who was a Freemason was actually involved in that. A lot of fine, upstanding people have actually been involved in Freemasonry. And this idea that he had of bringing the world under British rule, the whole point of that was because he saw that the British were the most merciful, the most just, the most law-abiding, I think even still today, if you were to ask anybody in the world or anybody in the third world who they would most like to be judged by in a trial, they would say they would much rather be judged by the British. We did have a reputation for being merciful and sticking to the rule of law. And his idea was that if we had British people ruling the world, that would be better for everyone. So he did set up this secret society. I mean, I think you've said in the past, we need to become our own Freemasons, haven't you, Max? Or words along those lines, we need our own secret society?
Yes, I've advocated white people setting up a if we're forced to live in a multiracial, multicultural society, then yes, we do need to have our own Masonic organizations, because the ethnic minority groups that settle amongst us, they do automatically form their own Masonic groups and roundtable groups that are aimed to promote the interests of their people only. And to advance their people within our society without any care really for whether that advancement is at the expense of the host community. And so therefore, if we're going to be forced to live in a multicultural society, then we have to adopt the tactics that make ethnic groups successful in a multicultural setting. And the way in which ethnic groups become successful in a multicultural setting is to develop an approach of in-group preference, where they regard their people as their in-group and everybody else as the out-group, and where they give preference to their people when their people are in competition with people who are from the out-group. And that's what we must do if we are going to be forced to live in a multicultural society in order to be successful.
Well, we do. We have our own networks, don't we? And, you know, we know when we meet, if we meet somebody that we haven't met before, but we've heard of them through the nationalist grapevine, through the nationalist community, you know, that they're going to be an all right person. You sort of know, the sort of values that they are going to have. You would hope that they're going to have a good character, a good spiritual character. So I think in effect, we do have our own sort of parallel organizations. We don't have the funny handshakes, we don't have the rituals, we don't have the oaths, but we do look out for one another and help one another out once we get into trouble, which is or if we get into trouble, which is the, you know, that's the sort of thing that the Freemasons do, isn't it? They call it the Brotherhood. So I think Cecil Rhodes was sort of looking at the positive things from that and what he could learn from it when he set up this organization to try and get America back into the British Empire and have the world ruled by Britain. I mean, this guy's a real British patriot, basically, isn't he? I mean, he loves Britain and he wants to advance Britain because he thinks that would be best for everybody else. You know, this is a real old school traditional way of looking at being British. And it was this attitude that meant that people were willing to lay down their lives for their country in the war because they loved their country so much, and they loved their country so much because they thought it was the very best. Why wouldn't anybody else want to be ruled by Britain? You know,
and I think in the modern day, the very fact that an overwhelmingly disproportionate number of migrants coming into Europe head straight for Calais, and they want to get across the English Channel and get into Britain. They aren't really interested so much in staying in any other countries because they know that, you know, that they find the society that we've created to be a very attractive society to live in, and so this again supports what you're saying.
Well, once after that, he made his way to South Africa, and in 1874 and 1875, the diamond fields were in the grip of depression, but Rhodes and his associate Rudd were among those who stayed to consolidate their interests. They believed that diamonds would be numerous in the hard blue ground that had been exposed after the softer yellow layer near the surface had already been worked out. During this time, the technical problem of clearing out the water that was flooding the mines became serious, and Rhodes and Rudd actually obtained the contract for pumping the water out of the three main mines. So this was sort of how they managed to get their first bit of money together. Do you know much about the diamond mining industry in South Africa, Max?
Only pretty much what you've just said.
Okay, Rhodes and his business partner Rudd launched De Beers Consolidated after the amalgamation of a number of individual claims, and Rhodes was named the chairman of De Beers at the company's founding in 1888. And De Beers was established with funding from N.M. Rothschild and Sons in 1887. Nathan Rothschild. So this was the link that he had with the Rothschilds. It was basically with Rothschild money that the De Beers Mining Company was set up. It doesn't necessarily mean that Cecil Rhodes was involved in the sort of nefarious activities that the Rothschilds were involved in. It meant that they needed funding, and that was who you got your funding from, because the Rothschilds just ran all the banks. I mean, it must have been pretty hard to actually run a business without having some kind of a connection to Jewish bankers at the time. Would you say that was accurate, Max?
Yes, I would say that was accurate. In order to carry out any sort of exploration, you know, we've already sort of spoken about this before, but in order to carry out any sort of explanation, any exploration, there has to be a significant amount of fundraising done beforehand. And of course, in order to raise funds, you go to people who have got lots of money. And the very fact that the money that was used in order to fund the mining developments and things that Cecil Rhodes was involved in, and that money was obtained through the Rothschilds, doesn't mean that there was anything necessarily wrong with what they were doing, because obviously organizations, the sort of Jewish banking organizations, would be involved in a lot of business arrangements and business deals, many of which would be perfectly above board and perfectly respectable, so that there's no need to cast a shadow over Cecil Rhodes just simply because he was using Rothschild money in order to carry out the mining developments that he was involved in.
Well, they would have only invested in people that they knew were going to get them a good return on their money as well. So it shows you that they saw that he was, you know, somebody that was hard working, and they invested in him. And also, I mean, the reason that the Jews had this money, that was the reason why they were allowed back into England. You know, the British people, or the people in Parliament, had seen the success that Holland was having with the Dutch East India Company, and looking at the way that the Jewish banking had helped Holland, or that was the way they saw it, and they wanted the same for Britain. And once the Jews were in Britain, I mean, you have to admit that was when the British Empire took off, and a lot of it was with this Jewish money, which of course, you know, meant that the money didn't really trickle down to the British people. It ended up in a lot of the wealthy bankers' pockets, but there was the opportunities there, as we said last week, for, you know, the brightest of the British people to then go out to the outposts of the empire and set a good example and make lives for themselves, instead of it just being, you know, the rich aristocracy that could make their way in life, as it was on the continent. And Rhodes actually became Prime Minister in 1890. He became the Prime Minister of the Cape Colony. He introduced the Glen Grey Act to make land available for industrial development, which had previously been settled on by blacks. Rhodes' view was that black people needed to be driven off the land to stimulate them to labour and to change their habits. It must be brought home to them, Rhodes said, that in future, 9/10 of them will have to spend their lives in manual labour, and the sooner that is brought home to them, the better. Now, they're trying to make this out to be a bad thing here, but basically they weren't used to working. So what he was basically saying is that they need to get used to working, they need to get used to doing manual labour, because then they will be rewarded for that, and with the reward that they get for that, then they'll be able to purchase the goods that they want, because they can see what the white people have, and they wanted that for themselves, and they needed to understand that it was hard work that actually got that for them. And also they needed to understand that the land that they were living on could be turned into land that was productive, land that would earn them money, that they could work on this land, they could work on the mines there, they could work in agriculture there. So this Glen Grey Act that was basically saying that the, moving them off this land, it was because that land was productive land. Do you want to make any comments on that, Max? This Glenn Gray Act?
Well, it's just that there are around the world, even to this very day, there are remnant human groups that are still practicing a hunter-gatherer lifestyle, and the reason why they are today very vulnerable in the environments in which they live is because they have lack the wherewithal to defend themselves against a human population that's expanding all around them. And so they find themselves each generation squeezed and squeezed into smaller and smaller plots of land by developers, etc. And you know, whether you think that from an ecological perspective this development is a good thing or not, the fact of the matter is that if people want to have the kind of the standard of living that we enjoy in the West, then all over the world those people need to organize themselves and organize their labor in such a way that they generate the goods and services that that are necessary in order to support that standard of living. And and this is part of what Rhodes was attempting to do here. And I think this is part of what you know, although Rhodes is often described as being racist in the approach that he had, this is a situation where he was effectively acting in a paternalistic way, obviously a way that would benefit his organization and the sponsors of his organization, but in a way which was intended also to provide the natives of Africa with a means by which they would be able to generate the goods and services that were necessary for them to also enjoy the sort of standard of living that we enjoy in the developed world.
It's providing employment for them. And it was of mutual benefit to them and to himself. Given the growing number of enfranchised black people in the Cape, Rhodes raised the franchise property requirements in 1892 to counter this preponderance by simultaneously limiting the amount of land which black Africans were legally allowed to hold, whilst tripling the property qualifications required to vote. Rhodes succeeded in ensuring that South African democracy was not subverted by the black newcomers. I mean, this is a really sensible thing that he actually did here, because you could see that the more black landowners that you had, and with the high fertility that they had, the quicker they would start to outnumber the white people. And if you had a democracy there, which you did, then pretty quickly South Africa would start to look like it does today, where you have black people voting for blacks, basically, and messing the country up. And he could see that that was likely to happen. And also, I mean, when you think about it, this is how democracy gets subverted, is by a new group of people coming into a country that's already been established. And then because they're all given the vote, they just take over the direction that that country is going. And he quite sensibly didn't want that to happen. I mean, this is what we should be doing everywhere. We shouldn't be allowing newcomers to the country to take part in the democratic process. The argument is, oh, they pay taxes, so they have a right to a say in those laws. I don't think that is logical. You know, if a white man goes to, say Malaysia and works in Malaysia, he shouldn't have a right to have a say in the laws over there just because he's working over there and earning money over there. Of course, he should be paying tax to the country over there because that's where he's working and earning. But he certainly shouldn't be having a say in what direction the country's going in. You know, that country was built by the Malaysians, and it's the same in Europe. Newcomers should not have a say in what way the country is going. If they want to come here to work and there is work for them, then that's fair enough. But it shouldn't entitle them to taking part in the democratic process. So what he was doing here was quite sensible. He wasn't kicking these people out. He was just saying that in order to be able to vote, you have to first have shown that you have sufficient know-how and sufficient knowledge to have earned enough money to buy property. You have to have a stake in what is going on here before you should have a right to take place in the franchise. Do you want to comment on this, Max?
Well, I think it's difficult for us to understand completely the situation that would have existed in Africa at the time. And I think that people who are critics of Rhodes will probably apply modern day standards, and they will perhaps even apply the what they see in Africa today and assume that African society was the same even in those days, when in reality it would have been very, very different to what it is today. And it would have been different in the sense that the European settlers who settled South Africa and who then migrated north, as they migrated north, they were establishing farms, they were establishing towns, they were establishing roads, etc. And they would have been met by people who were subsistence hunter-gatherers primarily. I think some of the Bantu tribes, like the Zulus, may have had some form of primitive, or sort of rudimentary agriculture, I should say. But they wouldn't have had a sophisticated society where the people actually understood what would be needed in order to turn South Africa into a developed country along the European model. As the white farmers and the white landowners allowed the native Africans to migrate south into South Africa in order to take up jobs of manual labour, etc., then they obviously realised that they couldn't offer the vote to all of those people until those people had, as you say, demonstrated that they had enough about them to understand the issues at stake.
Yeah, demonstrated that they were qualified to take part in something so important as deciding who's going to be running the government. I mean, it's something that we just don't discuss today. We just say that everybody can have the vote, and really that's just the rule of the mob, isn't it? It's only a very small percentage of people that are qualified to make decisions, or qualified to make the right decisions about something. And what we say is, we'll let the majority decide. And the majority, by definition, are going to be the least informed on a subject. You want the most informed people to be making the decisions, and you want those people to be making the votes, not the people that are just swayed by what they see on television. And what you had here, I mean, because you had so many of these blacks here, the communists were able to get them to subvert democracy in Rhodesia, as we will see later on. It could have very easily happened decades before, round about this time, if Rhodes hadn't made this decision that they would have to actually have more money first and more property first before they could vote. In addition, Rhodes was an early architect of the Natives Land Act 1913, which would limit the areas of the country where black Africans were allowed to settle to less than 10%, but at the same time guarantee that they had some land that they could call their own. At the time, Rhodes would argue that the native is to be treated as a child and denied the franchise. We must adopt a system of despotism such as works in India in our relations with the barbarism of South Africa. And, you might think, well, those are strong terms to use, but, you had cannibals at this land at this time. And as you were saying, Max, there were hunters and gatherers. And how are they supposed to understand the way that democracy works? And this was looked at right the way across the British Empire. What we need to do is we need to raise the standards of these people until they're at such a level that they can manage their own democracies, and then we will leave those countries, which is in effect what happened after the war. We left these countries to their own devices, basically, but then unfortunately we allowed them to come into ours, which was the big mistake. But it was always looked upon as eventually these people will be able to rule themselves. It wasn't looked upon as these people are slaves to work for us. I mean, as he says here, he's not saying the native needs to be treated as a slave, but the native needs to be treated as a child. So you got that paternal influence there, that you were referring to, Max. And you know, even looking at the literature that was produced by the slave owners in America, they looked upon the blacks as a childlike race. They looked upon them as a race that had yet to mature. And in the traditional white way, you know, you look at innocence, or you look at people that aren't really capable of doing things for themselves, and you protect them, and you look after them, and you try to set a good example to them. And that was the mentality that these people had. It wasn't, you know, these savages, we should kill them all. You know, what he was saying here is, well, we're going to give them some land, and that's going to be their own. Obviously, we can't allow them to take over just by their numbers. There was nobody here at first. We built this civilization, but we're not just going to put a big wall around it and not allow any of them in. We'll allow them in, and we'll allow them to have 10% of the land, and we'll build them hospitals, we'll build them schools, and we'll teach them, and hopefully at one stage in the future, they'll be able to rule themselves. And that was all. That was always the mentality that people had. Do you want to comment on this about the Natives Land Act?
Yeah, just the fact that I think it's well known as far as Rhodes is concerned that he was prepared to, you know, he did a lot of wheeler dealing in terms of building the civilization that was created in South Africa. But in doing so, he didn't exclude non-Europeans who demonstrated that they were quite capable of positively contributing to their society. And so he did deals with native Africans who were perhaps the children of chiefs, or who were actually the chiefs of the various tribes, who had been sent to Europe and who had attended university in Europe and who knew the ways of the world, etc., and who had returned to the country, and he treated those people fairly and made deals with them so that in order to establish the an environment that was conducive to building the new country and creating civilization effectively. And it's interesting. I mean, if you read, there's a book written by A.K. Chesterton, which is called The New Unhappy Lords. And in there, he details the sort of things that happened when a lot of the African countries first achieved independence from Britain and from other European countries. And one of the things he points to is that Jomo Kenyatta, who was the founder of Kenya, Kenyatta's surname actually means burning spear. And the reason why he was called Jomo Burning Spear is because the symbol of a burning spear was what was used to symbolize his political party. And I think there was another political party in the same initial elections that took place that represented themselves with a symbol of an elephant. And he details in this book, The Unhappy Lords, that it was quite common to find Africans debating the utility and the value of a burning spear versus that of an elephant in discussing which political party they were going to vote for in their initial elections. And because they were promised freedom, they didn't really understand what freedom was. And so in the days following the elections where Kenyatta was first elected, there were native Africans turning up at the polling stations and at council offices with a bucket ready to collect their freedom and take it home. They didn't realize that they were voting for something which was abstract and not something which was an article that they could take away with themselves. A good read of A.K. Chesterton's New Unhappy Lords puts you in the right frame of mind in order to judge whether what Rhodes did in Africa was good or not.
Did he write much about the British Empire, A.K. Chesterton, just out of interest?
He wrote a great deal about the period of transition from empire to the modern era, basically, and he points to what happened in Zambia and South Africa and the various developments that took place, and also a lot of the political behind the scenes scheming that took place in which the white settlers and the initial white governments that had benevolent intentions that they were subverted, and we have this situation in Africa today where lots of the countries are such that their populations are worse off today than they would have been had colonial rule continued.
And there was the League of Empire Loyalists, which was like a nationalist organisation that supported the British Empire, that then went on to become the National Front and the BNP. Because I wondered what would be good books to read about the British Empire, because children today are just not taught about it. You know, you've got the Labour Party and they want to teach children that the legacy of empire was horrific and terrible and slavery and blah, blah, blah. But yet at the time, you know, we had Empire Day once a year, where the kids would dress up as part of the, one of the countries from the empire. And it was looked upon as a very positive thing, and that the British people were doing a very good thing here by helping to civilize these people. But in order to do that, you had to have a separation between those people and the whites. It's just a sensible way to do things. Why is it so horrific that the blacks were living among the blacks and the whites were living among the whites? It's going to be preferable to live among your own kind. Well, Rhodes used his wealth and that of his business partner Alfred Beart and other investors to pursue his dream of creating a British empire in new territories to the north by obtaining mineral concessions from the most powerful indigenous chiefs, and he often collaborated with the British government's local representatives, the British Commission, and through them organised British protectorates over the mineral concession areas via separate but related treaties. In this way, he obtained both legality and security for mining operations. He could then attract more investors. Imperial expansion and capital investment went hand in hand, but the imperial factor was a double-edged sword. Rhodes did not want the bureaucrats of the colonial office in London to interfere in the empire in Africa. He wanted British settlers and local politicians and governors to run the place. And this put him on a collision course with many in Britain, as well as with British missionaries, who favoured what they saw as the more ethical direct rule from London. So you had a bit of friction there between him and the way they wanted to run the empire from London, but at the same time he wanted to have local people running things in South Africa, and he was the representative of the empire. And you can see the way that the British government and the empire dovetailed in with trade and development and protecting these lands that were being developed for mining and all sorts of other things. Eventually we get to Rhodesia, and we'll deal with that next week. Max, do you want to comment on this, the relationship between the British Empire and the actual developers here?
Well, I think that what you've got there is the situation where once an empire reaches a certain size, particularly at a time when transport and intercontinental communications are fairly limited in the way that they would have been back in the 19th century and the early 20th century, then there would grow up a degree of, it would be problematic for London to have had direct rule in every sense over all of the far-flung parts of the empire. And so just as we had with the USA, the people in North America would decide that the edicts that they were receiving from London wouldn't necessarily coincide with what they wanted to do, and they would feel that these were rulings that were being imposed upon them by people who knew nothing about their life and the land on which they lived. And so I think any kind of large empire has to in some way have some element of subsidiarity in which the local people have a significant, if not the dominant, say in the way in which their particular colonial area is governed.
Now, he was the man on the ground. You know, he could see what needed to be done. I should imagine London was a bit like a backseat driver, and could get quite infuriating at times. And, you know, he was obviously very well liked by the Africans, as we'll see. I mean, they named Rhodesia after him, and he had a huge funeral. It's not like he was thought of in a bad way at all by the African natives or by the South African people. He was seen as a really good man, as we will see next week. Anyway, well, that brings us to the end of this week's episode. Thank you very much for coming on, Max. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. Don't forget that we do require donations to keep Radio Albion going, and you can donate to us via our Bitcoin wallet, which you will find at the bottom of every page. We will be back next week with more Aryan Britannia for you, and of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.